If you want to grab your Bibles, open up to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, if you don't know where that one is, if you open up just dead smack in the middle, you'll probably be in Psalms. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. So you're really close at that point. Now, as I said, we're launching this series, Explore God, this morning, which involves spiritual conversation around life's key questions. Now, we are different people and come from different places, certainly. So different points on our spiritual journeys, let's say. Some of you are here and you're going, yeah, I got no idea about any of this. I'm not confident that God exists. Somebody invited me. I'm here because I felt bad saying no. So, okay, great. Well, something for you. Some of you have been here for a long time. These questions are still important for us. Like some of you probably grew up in the church. And so if I were to ask the question, is the Bible reliable? You go, of course, because that's what's been taught me my whole life. And at some point, it's going to get challenged. And how do you know the Bible's reliable? And we go, okay, we should think about this. And so that's what we're doing in this series. These are not questions that we can ignore, at least not with any intellectual honesty, because they're too important to our lives, no matter where we are or what we claim to believe. These are also not questions that we're ever going to fully answer in this life, and certainly not in a seven-week series. Like, I just laugh. This is a fair warning for the whole series. You know, they're like, why don't you answer the question, why does God allow pain and suffering? You got 30 minutes. Go. It's not going to be enough time. Okay, so we're gonna scratch the surface. This is a teaser in some ways of how we might answer these questions. Now, chief among them, in some ways, the first question we ask, that's why it's first in the series, is what is the meaning of life? Or the way it's phrased in the series, does life have a purpose? We ask this question. We do. Here's the way a famous rabbi, Abraham Heschel, put it. He said, it is not enough for me to be able to say I am. I want to know who I am and in relation to whom I live. It is not enough for me to ask questions. I want to know how to answer the one question that seems to encompass everything I face. What am I here for? That's the question. That's the longing we all have. We can't shake this sense of significance that we have, of meaning. But is that sense of significance grounded in any reality or not? And lately, in the last century or so, although we'll see there's some earlier question about this as well, people have suggested that it isn't grounded in reality. The significance is a dream we have. Samuel Beckett, absurdist writer, famous for his absurdist theater. Most famous play is Waiting for Godot. Perhaps you've seen it. If not, highly recommend it. Very good play. But what happens in this play is you've got two men carrying on trivial conversation, waiting for this third friend, Godot, to arrive. And he never does. And that's meant to point us to something. We're all waiting for the answer to arrive, and it never seems to. It's no coincidence, by the way, that Godot is spelled G-O-D, O-T, as in, is there a God? Is he going to ever give us the answer to the questions that we have, or are our lives like these two men in the play? Are we just killing time until time finally kills us? Actually, in another play that Beckett has, he staged, I don't think I could say he wrote it, the curtain rises to reveal a stage littered with junk, sits there for a little bit, and then the curtain falls. Even more poignant illustration of that's it, that's what your life is, okay? All the world's a stage, it's just littered with junk and it has no meaning. Here's what he said, if you like it a little bit more directly. They give birth astride of a grave. The light gleams an instant, then it's night once more. There you go, that's life. If you prefer Hemingway, he said it like this. Life is just a dirty trick, a short journey from nothingness to nothingness. No, these are thoughts we've all had, if you're old enough at least. You've had this thought at some point or another. Is life just a dirty trick? Usually these thoughts come in moments of painful reflection prompted by some experience of pain, of longing. Might happen, separation or end of a relationship might happen with the loss of a loved one. More often, it just happens those mornings when you wake up and with a heavy sigh think, is this all there is? Like, I got to do this again today. These are the questions we've had. Now, you'll notice I quoted a bunch of 20th century writers there. Beckett and Hemingway, guys like this. They're following in the footsteps of that great 19th century thinker, probably the most influential atheist who's ever lived, Friedrich Nietzsche, who famously proclaimed the death of God, which is what would strip away this sense of significance from our lives. And as Nietzsche noted, if God is dead, then really we are too. That was the point of so much of his writing. It drove him insane and drove his followers to the brink of suicide, and in some cases actually to suicide, or at least to contemplate suicide, guys like Albert Camus. But if God's dead, it strips away the possibility of answering some of these questions that we have. But what I love about this is we don't have to wait for Nietzsche or Camus or Beckett to have this conversation. The Bible, which addresses life's most important questions, hits it head on. About 3 millennia earlier, it tackles this question directly in the book of Ecclesiastes, where we are this morning. Now, Ecclesiastes is a strange book. Like, if you haven't read the whole Bible, and so, like, you just read some of the Gospels, you kind of know Genesis, like that flood thing and stuff, and you come to Ecclesiastes, it's a bit of a shock. Probably would have the response my kids had as they were reading the passage in preparation for our sermon this morning, where and one of them just said, "Why is this in the Bible? Like, this does not fit." It's true. It really doesn't seem to at all. But it's asking this question, does life have a purpose? Does it have meaning? If so, how would we figure that out? So let me read verses 1 to 11 to start us off at least. Here's Ecclesiastes chapter 1, 1 to 11. "The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem, meaningless, meaningless," says the teacher, "utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, turns to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, 'Look, this is something new'? No, it was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them." Heartbreaking honesty of this son of David. Doesn't mean his literal son, just means descendant of some sort. It's a broad word. And he's apparently king in Jerusalem. So we've got a figure like Solomon, at least. That's the most we can say. People think this is actually Solomon. Might be, might not be. Doesn't matter. But we got a figure like Solomon who's king. That's important because that means that's somebody who has it all. Solomon had wisdom. He had riches. He had fame. He had a whole lot of women. He had power. You name it, he had it. He's the one writing this. And he says, meaningless. This is all meaningless. If you like the King James better, it says vanity. It's a good translation of this word because the whole idea is the search is in vain. The word that's used, the Hebrew word, means vapor. You imagine going outside on a day like today and you breathe out your hot air and a little steam happens thing, right? Try and grab that. Like, that's the picture that Ecclesiastes has for us. The search is in vain. You can try, it's there, I see it, but I can't seem to grasp it. I get the things I was trying to get, but none of them seem to satisfy. What do people gain, he says in verse 3. All that effort, all that frenetic striving of the daily grind, and there's Hemingway still. No, this is just a dirty trick. Or the eye never has enough of seeing, verse 8, nor the ear its fill of hearing. I keep looking, I keep listening, I'm acquiring, but I'm never fulfilled. I'm never filled full like I want to be. We are buckets with holes. We keep pouring happiness in and it just drains out the bottom. So now you can see why my girls asked and why you're probably asking, why is this in the Bible? This does not feel like the rest of Scripture. Parts really don't sound like the rest of Scripture, but the answer is in that key phrase repeated so often in Ecclesiastes, under the sun. Under the sun. So what we have here is a writer who's taking us on a little thought experiment. Let's just stick to what's under the sun. Let's pretend that there is nothing else out there. This is just this world. So it's a thought experiment like secularism. or naturalism. The natural world is all there is. The physical world, there is no metaphysical. So let's take God out of the equation. Can we still find meaning and satisfaction apart from him? We'll begin to see even why life so often leaves even believers feeling unsatisfied. Will there be a something new, verse 10, that finally satisfies? Now, I'm going to quote lots of dead people because of verse 11. Because we are not the first generation to do this. No one remembers the former generations. They've already tried this one out like 3 million or 3,000 years ago. So, in truth, my problem with guys like Nietzsche, and I've read Nietzsche, and he's a fascinating character for sure. My problem with Nietzsche is not his thought that God is dead. My problem with Nietzsche is in him thinking his thought was new. It wasn't. It wasn't at all. We already have it. God, if he exists, put it in his book, if that's what this is, to challenge us with these same questions. What happens if he is dead? So I'm going to give us a brief overview of the book, looking at some of the main attempts that humans take to try and find meaning or purpose or satisfaction. So you're going to be flipping pages a little bit, that's okay. But let's just keep reading for now, verses 13 to 18, and look at the search for meaning in knowledge, wisdom. I applied my mind to study, he says, and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly, but I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. What I like about this is that there's a little bit of a chronological development here. I'm not sure if that's intended, but it almost takes us through life stages. And where do we start? We start in school. And that's where we are at this point. So some of you are there now. You're in high school, you're in college, and you're doing what he's doing, which is applying your mind to study. Now remember our phrase, under the sun, that's what he's doing here too. So this is searching for knowledge without God. In essence, this is the scientific enterprise. Now, science doesn't say God doesn't exist, but it says we're going to function as though he doesn't exist. We're going to see if we can find natural causes for all that happens in the world. So we're going to take the naturalist assumption here. And now even the search for meaning, of course, is included in this quest. This is Philosophy 101. What is the meaning of life? There it is. And it's there in verse 14 and verse 17. It's referred to as a chasing after the wind. What's the problem with chasing the wind? You can't grab the wind. Like nobody's ever caught the wind. That just doesn't happen. So what's the big issue with this approach? Our teacher says it's this, that what is crooked can't be made straight. And some of you are like, no, you can. Like, I've seen people work with metal and stuff, and you can straighten things that are crooked. What is he talking about? He's talking about the human heart. That's what's crooked. In fact, in Luther's phrase, it's bent in on itself. That is, we're all self-absorbed. That is the origin of the evil that is in this world. And that's the problem. So we're bent, we're crooked, and education alone can't possibly change the human heart. There was a time in human history where people thought that it really could. This is the early 20th century, late 19th century. All of a sudden, you know, scientific knowledge was exploding, and people were thinking, if we just get enough education, a little bit more scientific knowledge, we are going to be able to cure the world's problems. It was this age of science and progress. And it was punctuated by World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II, and all that idealism got stripped away. Which is why, by the way, all these writers that I'm quoting, they happen in like the 1920s to 1950s, right when humanity is really at its nadir in some ways. That idealism just, it gives way to despair. There's no technological fix to racism, sexual exploitation, selfishness. And we begin to learn this. Tim Keller, commenting on this passage, says it like this: the more we know, the more we see how little we know about the things that truly matter, at least. Or the way our writer says it, the more knowledge, the more grief. It's interesting. We're never more arrogant than like our sophomore year of college. Because when you're in your 20s, those of you who are laughing are older than that now. But those of you who are not laughing are like, hey, no. It's true, true in my own life, I can acknowledge this. We're right there in our early 20s because we've got as much knowledge as we think we're ever going to have, and we think that it matters, and we're going to make a difference. shattered, very early. That's actually what the word sophomore means, right? Like wise fool, soph, as in wisdom. And moron is the Greek word. That's the word that's used there. Some of you are like, that can't be right. It's true. You're a wise moron. You don't know that you don't know at that point. Some of you are really not happy with this part of the sermon. That's okay. All right. We move to the next phase then, meaningless pleasure, the search for satisfaction, for meaning and pleasure. Let me read some parts of chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, and then I'm going to jump down to verses 10 to 11. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. Drop down to verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. So sometime in college, if we're going chronologically still, or maybe shortly thereafter, you turn to hedonism. Broadly defined, I'm not in like winking version of this, euphemistic hedonism. No, we're talking about just pursuing pleasure, what it is that you think will make you happy. Now, that might include illicit pleasure. That might just be the American dream, though. The teacher actually seems to imply both in this passage. What does he do at first? He says, I cheered myself with wine and I embraced folly. That one sounds like youthful indiscretions or something where we are actually winking at this point. But then he goes on in verses 4 and following, the part that I skipped, to build houses and careers for himself. Well, that sounds more like the American dream. What is the conclusion after all? It's a bit jolting. Laughter is madness. Why? Because it's fleeting. It's temporary. What does pleasure accomplish? It doesn't accomplish anything other than it distracts you for a moment. Now, if you choose the wine approach, well, your drunken joy still gives way to the hangover the next morning. Or if you choose the other approach, your vacation still ends with you waiting in the TSA line, right? So we've got this enormous output of time and money and energy for what is at best a temporary reprieve. It doesn't last. Beckett actually talked about this as well. So it was one of those beautiful days, you know, blue sky, sunny, warm. He's there with his friends having a beer watching a cricket game. So this is like as good as it gets. And his friend comments to him, this is the sort of day that makes one glad to be alive. And Beckett, because he'd imbibed all these questions, said, I don't think I'd go as far as that. Because what's it going to do? So the weather's going to turn? Cricket game's going to end? You know, I'm like, what did this do exactly? There are two ways for us to see that chasing pleasure will never work, doesn't work, and can't work. It is a chasing after the wind. The first way to see this is in the prevalence of addiction. Now, addiction might mean substance addiction, drugs or alcohol, but it might be that you're addicted to sex. The burgeoning industry, sex addiction recovery. It might be video games or TV. You might be addicted to approval. Compliments, applause, or you might be addicted to try and make yourself look as beautiful as possible. What's the problem with all these? Where does addiction come from? It's an acknowledgement that none of it actually satisfied. So the high eventually fades, you need another hit. And actually, what do you find over time? You need more and more of the same substance to get less and less of a result. It doesn't work. And again, that might be heroin, but that might be compliments. The notice of your peers. The other place we see this is in the ever-expanding dream. We look at something like the American dream, and it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because as soon as you attain it, you go, no, that wasn't enough. So you start off with if I could just get a good job, and this is like good for a little while, but then you want marriage after that. Actually, remember, a girl, she was a senior in high school, and my wife was working with her, and she said at one point, well, if I could just get married, that would be enough. My wife, who had been married for a few years at that point to me, just laughed at her. I took a little offense at that, I'm not going to lie. Because you won't. That isn't enough. It'll be good for you for a year or two, and then you're going to go, no, I need something more still. And so then you need the kids, or you need the house, you need the second career, you need the promotion, then you need a bigger house. Actually, I think houses are the place to see this more than anywhere else. Like, you look at homes built in the 40s, and then in the 60s, and then today, and what do you see? They just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Less and less people in them. Is there any more happiness in them? No. But more and more to get the same result at best. Pleasure is meaningless. Let's keep going. Verses 20 to 23, dropping down a little bit, to the search for meaning in achievement. Let me read it for us. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. So that word toil there in verse 20 shows us the cost of our achievement. Again, we use phrases like the daily grind to describe our labor. And it makes you start to think, what's being ground here exactly? Like me, I'm the one who's like the eraser over time and it's just a nub by the end of it. And yet we still devote the largest portion of our lives to this quest. You know, it's like 20s until retirement. Now, teacher is going to point out two reasons why this search fails. First, verse 21, we have to leave it all to somebody else who did not toil for it. That's your ungrateful kids, by the way, right? Maybe it's somebody else. It's fine. But at death, remember, we're talking under the sun. The one truth on which we can all agree under the sun is you're going to die. That's how this story ends. So at death, if there's nothing beyond death, because we're under the sun, all our toil is for naught. The government takes whatever's left in your 401k. The kids sell that house that you finally paid off. Even if you've achieved great things in your career, it's not going to survive. It just isn't going to make it. Maybe a generation or two if you're impressive. Not going beyond that. Like, this is my grandfather's story. He was an incredibly successful man. He was part of the team that invented radar during World War II and then went on from there. Tremendous technological advancements, all sorts of stuff. He was quite wealthy and all that. Within 5 years of his death, the company was belly up. It was gone. Now, who do you think is going to remember that my grandfather was part of the team that invented radar? I do. Maybe my kids will hear me say it often enough in sermons that they'll go, yeah, like somebody in my dad's family, something about something. But that's it. And then it's gone. This is true even of the greatest people who ever lived. Percy Shelley, who was very much in that hedonistic search for meaning kind of camp, he wrote this, you know, a short little sonnet. I'm just going to read the last part, but it's about a wanderer in the desert who comes across the wreck of this great statue, this great man. It says this, "My name is Ozymandias." This is the inscription on the statue. "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." This is a guy who did it, right? He achieved. "Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." That's all he's got. Like, he got a big statue. That's pretty cool. I'm not getting a statue. It fell over, and there's just sand covering his kingdom. By the way, this is like a true story. I don't think the guy's name was Ozymandias, but this is what happened to Babylon. Like, the mightiest empire on earth at that time was so completely destroyed and the sands covered it that for a long time, up until just recently, like a century or so ago, people actually thought Babylon didn't exist. It was one of the ways they knew the Bible wasn't true. Oops. It was because we keep talking about Babylon and there is no Babylon. They finally found it. Babylon! Gone! That's our lives. Second reason this doesn't work is that it doesn't satisfy anyway, all this achievement. Our days are, verse 23, filled with grief and pain. Even at night, our minds do not rest. Why are they so restless? We know it isn't enough, and we know it could all end. I talked to some of you who work, and this restlessness is there. You're going to mess up and get fired, or it's just going to be you get laid off. Company's going down the drains. There's a reorg. You got no security for your wallet. Really got no security for yourself, sense of self either. You see this, too, in the desire both for promotion and for retirement, which everybody expresses at some point or another. The desire for promotion, the desire for retirement give the lie to the whole notion of achievement. We want more, and then we want to be done. So clearly this isn't satisfying. Well, let's go. One more. Meaningless riches here. You're going to have to flip over a little bit. Chapter 5, let me read verses 10 to 15. Work might not satisfy, but at least it gives you money. Maybe that can buy you the things that satisfy. Let's see. Chapter 5, 10 to 15. Whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with her income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether they eat little or much. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owners, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when they have children, there is nothing left for them to inherit. Everyone comes naked from their mother's womb, and as everyone comes, so they depart. They take nothing from their toil that they can carry in their hands. So will money satisfy? Surely not. I think we all know this one, too. We don't live like we know it, but deep down, we all know this to be true. We never have enough. At least most of us are never going to get to that point, which is why if you ask people what it means to be rich, it's just a little bit beyond what you have. Like, that's always, nobody ever says, I'm at the level that's rich. No, it's they are rich, not me. If I had a little bit more, that would be different. But what benefit do goods provide except to stare lovingly at them? Verse 11. We get bored so easily with our stuff. This is the curse of Christmas, isn't it? Like, you watch your kids, you get them all this stuff, and at the end they're like, is that it? You're like, is that it? You pack these things up, we're going to Salvation Army, we'll see if those kids like these things, right? We're the same way. Like, you still get your shiny new toy. It's a Lexus instead of a toy, but whatever, it's still a toy. And after a little while, is this it? Is this it? Now, again, two possible outcomes, both bad. You can hoard wealth or you can lose wealth. Otherwise, you can have money or you can not have money. Those are pretty much the two options. Both of them are bad. You have money, you amass wealth. Well, that harms the owners. You spend all your time worrying about losing it, verse 12. Plus, your heart is weighed down by the treasure. We talked a lot about this in a recent series. Or you lose your wealth. You don't have the money. That harms kids. A teacher says, you feel like you can't provide for the ones that you love. And of course, that danger is always lurking, that what you have, you will lose. Plus, right there at the end of this section, verse 15, you die anyway. Remember, we're under the sun still. You can't take it with you. I told this story not too long ago. John D. Rockefeller, one of the wealthiest men who ever lived, and he died. And somebody asked his accountant, how much did John D. leave? And the accountant, with biblical wit, said, all of it. All of it. Doesn't matter what the number is. He didn't take any of it with him, and neither will we. You can begin to see, by the way, why it had to be somebody like Solomon who wrote this book, who had this conversation, because it had to be somebody who had it all so that they could tell us how little it means to have it all. And in fact, if we were to look at quotes from today's Solomons, and we will, we're going to see the exact same conclusion. We talk sometimes about people being fortunate. That's what it means if they got money. Here's the fortune involved. They have enough to know that it doesn't matter. Like, we can always still be looking and go, but if I were prettier, if I were more famous, if I had the job I wanted, if I had the money, and they can say, no, all that, and it still doesn't matter. I quote Madonna a lot. She had it all, right? Everything. She said fame and fortune isn't what it's cracked up to be. I've quoted Anthony Hopkins before. You get to the top of the tree, there's nothing there. Let me quote Marcus Persson today. Some of you may know him better as Notch, which is his handle. He's the guy who invented Minecraft, sold it to Microsoft for, like cool $2.5 billion. Sounds good. Here's what he tweeted not long after that. The problem with getting everything is you run out of reasons to keep trying. Isn't that interesting? Keep trying to do what? You have everything. And yet he still felt like he needed to try. Why? Because he wasn't satisfied. He even talks about, I'm hanging out in Ibiza in the $70 million house that he owns, wild parties with the beautiful women, and I've never felt more isolated, he said. Or Tom Brady, one of my favorite examples of this. So everybody's favorite football villain. We're all rooting against him today. And what? And this is a decade and a half ago now that he said this. He said, why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life. Me, I think, God, it's gotta be more than this. I love that that's phrased as a prayer, by the way. I'm not sure that's how he intended it, but that's what it is. God, it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be what it's all cracked up to be. I mean, I've done it. I'm 27, he's now 41, 27, and what else is there for me? What else is there for me? He's married to a supermodel. He keeps winning, irritatingly, oodles of cash, fame, accolades, none of it satisfied. And how could it? He's getting older, by the way. He is not as good as he used to be. So he's over 40. His wife is coming up on 40, which if you're an athlete and a supermodel, that's like 190. You're like dead, halfway decayed. People are going to forget him. Nobody remembers quarterbacks from a long time ago. Money is, we know that doesn't satisfy. Where do we go? So flip into that last section, the search for meaning. It's starting to feel like Beckett was onto something. Like life might just be a stage littered with junk. Some of us have nicer junk than others, but it's still all junk. But what if that feeling of meaninglessness, that desire for satisfaction is a pointer to true meaning? This, by the way, is exactly what the teacher says. A part that I skipped over, tucked away in chapter 3, verse 11, he has also set eternity in the human heart. Such an important phrase, because now we get past the under the sun. This is the, yeah, but what if there's something more? He has set eternity forever in the human heart. What does that mean? That's the longing for the true and the lasting. Here's the way C.S. Lewis said it. Now, probably no writer that I can think of has spent more time dissecting this notion of longing than Lewis. It's safe to say, no exaggeration, this really was what all of his works are about. Whether that's the fiction like Chronicles of Narnia, you can see it on every page, and most of his nonfiction writing as well. He writes this at one point, "The human soul was made to enjoy some object that is never fully given, nay, cannot even be imagined as given in our present mode of existence." In our present mode of existence, let me translate that, under the sun. Cannot be given under the sun. He actually dramatizes this longing in his book, Pilgrim's Regress. It's the most difficult book by far. It's fascinating. It's worth reading, and it's sort of semi-autobiographical. But what is the pilgrimage? The guy is going after that feeling of longing. It's called Regress because he ends up where he started, but I'll let you read it for yourselves. But at one point, he says this. This is right after he's tried the hedonism piece, and he's talking to some hedonists. Actually, it's a group of artists. So be similar to the Becketts and Hemingways of the world, and they say, you've got what you wanted. And he says, no, if it is what I wanted, why am I so disappointed when I get it? If what a man really wanted was food, how could he be disappointed when the food arrived? And yet, that's us. And so he says, it's a longing for something beyond the desire. He gives it its fullest expression in an article he wrote called The Weight of Glory. He writes this, in speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, which we find in ourselves even now, I feel a certain shyness. I'm almost committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you. Exactly what I'm doing today, by the way. I feel indecent myself, going, no, I know you have this longing. I may never have met you before, and this longing exists in your heart, and we can try and close the curtains on it, but it's there, and we know it's there. Our commonest expedient is to call it beauty, and behave as if that settled the matter. But the books or music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. I don't know if you've had this experience. I love music, so this analogy makes sense to me. You hear a piece of music and it's transcendent. And so you go, you buy the album or you bring it up on Spotify, whatever happens today. I'm like, I own vinyl still, so I'm that guy. But you put it on again and you listen to it and you go, that's not quite what I remember. That's exactly what Lewis goes on to say. It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, the sorts of things that Ecclesiastes dissects, they're good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. That's what I expressed. Marcus Persson, Tom Brady, Madonna, Anthony Hopkins, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. For they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. Why is our search in this world for meaning and purpose and joy in vain? Well, it's because we were made for another world. If this world could satisfy, Solomon would have been satisfied, and Tom Brady would be satisfied, but but it can't, and so they weren't, and we aren't either. That's where Ecclesiastes ultimately leaves us, by the way. This book that's so odd, it ends on some biblical notes. Chapter 12, verse 1, right near the end of it, he says, remember your creator in the days of your youth. Which I like right there. These are words from the passing generation to the next. And you can almost hear him. This is like a high school commencement address in some ways. He's saying, let me talk to you now before you've gone too deep into this search, right? Before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. He's saying, before you get disappointed because you thought it was in marriage and money and pleasure and all these things, let me just tell you now, it isn't. So look somewhere else. Remember your creator in the days of your youth. There's nothing new under the sun that can satisfy, but there is something better yet, someone over the sun. And this is how the book ends. Chapter 12, verse 13. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. Some people read this and they go, man, that's a disappointing ending. This is the best he could do. It spoils it for some. They say, this book had such commendable honesty in it for us to end on the, no, God exists. It's okay. And yes, maybe if we gave into the honesty of the book, it would lead to unyielding despair, but at least it would still have honesty. That's one response. The other response would be to heed the message and to go, yes, with God and only with God, with the promise of immortality, only can life have meaning. We have eternity set in our hearts because eternity exists, because it is there in the God who has made it. Now, and when we begin to reflect like this, it's going to lead us inevitably to the cross. What was a thought experiment for the writer of Ecclesiastes became reality for Jesus. On the cross, he experiences a godless world when he's forsaken and damned by God. He cries out, his first words on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? In fact, it's interesting, the way back in Isaiah chapter 49, verse 4, which is a prophecy about God's suffering servant, so it's entirely appropriate for us to put these words on the lips of Jesus. We read this, but I said, I have labored in vain. It's meaningless. I've labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing at all. That's what Jesus is saying on the cross, isn't he? Look, I came announcing this kingdom. I came proclaiming peace and forgiveness and grace and love, and they crucified me for it. But he goes on, yet what is due me is in the Lord's hand, and my reward is with my God. Death is not the end. Eternity exists, and I can entrust this to God. What are his last words on the cross? Father, into your hands, I commit my spirit. The eternal peace of us. I know it's going to be okay. That is, this reflection leads us not just to the cross, but ultimately to the empty tomb as well. The tomb is empty. The resurrection of Christ, it's meant to be a deposit, a down payment, a promise and guarantee that our longing will be met. But hey, it's week one. We're still not within a half acre of these questions. So first step we got to ask now is, okay, if life only has meaning if God exists, well then, does God exist? And if he exists, can we know? And so I want to invite you back next week, same time, same place, especially if your answer to that question, does God exist, especially if it is, we know he doesn't exist, or we can't know if he exists. If you got either one of those questions, come back next week and let's talk about this some more. But for now, let me close by praying for us. And let me invite us all to pray. I realize there are some of you here who don't believe in God, or you're really not sure if you believe in God. Go ahead and pray along with me. God hears the prayers of people who don't believe in him. That's how we all first pray. And so if there's any part of this prayer that I offer that you agree with, just say, God, if you exist, I agree. That's all we're doing, all right? So join me in prayer. Oh God, we are here this morning asking the question that nags at all of us. Does life have meaning? Does life have a purpose? My prayer is simple. If you exist, God, and if purpose and meaning and satisfaction is found in you, would you reveal yourself to me? Would you show me where that satisfaction truly lies, what the longing in my heart is pointing to? I ask in Christ's name, amen and amen.